Hi, welcome to this week's program. Most of my listeners know of my love for the power of compounding. It's a terrific way to grow your wealth over time. Compounding works on the principle of investing a set amount of money into stocks or bonds and reinvesting your gains back into the pot. Repeat this year after year. Be patient. Give it 20, 30, 40 years, and you'll have wealth like you've never imagined. If you want to do even better, regularly invest money into that pot every month or every quarter, never withdraw anything, and diligently reinvest your gains. Then sit back, relax, and watch your wealth really, really snowball. The formula is pretty simple, which is another reason why I love it. I love anything that's simple and a stable way of passively increasing your wealth. Speaking of snowballing your wealth, I just read an article on Seeking Alpha titled How to Snowball Your Fortune with Benjamin Franklin. I'll put up a link to the article on my website, stevepomerantz.com, so you can read it too. The article was written by John Thomas, a 50-year veteran of the financial markets, who calls himself the mad hedge fund trader because he does crazy stuff like climbing Mount Everest, flying 90,000 feet in the cockpit of a Russian jet, and diving to the depths of a sunken Japanese fleet. In the article, John talks of the investing genius of Benjamin Franklin. Of course, Benjamin Franklin was one of our founding fathers and who was a member of the Committee of Five that drafted the Declaration of Independence and is the face on our $100 bill, which is why, of course, they're also called Benjamins. Now, while Ben was an extraordinary scientist, publisher, politician, educator, and man of many more talents, he also understood the basic math behind modern investment theory more than a century before it was conceived. There was another thing that Ben knew well ahead of everyone else, that betting against the U.S. was a fool's errand, even though we were the newest nation on Earth back in late 1700s. Ben's belief in America went against the widespread sentiment in Europe that our experimental democracy would soon fail. Europe, as you'll remember, was entirely ruled by kings back in the late 1700s, so the idea that democracy would survive was met with much scorn. So deep was Europe's conviction that America would fail as a nation-state that in 1789 a French mathematician, Charles-Joseph Mathon de la Cour, dared anyone to take him on a multi-century bet against the U.S.'s survival as a nation-state. When Ben learned of this bet, he jumped right in, betting against de la Cour and landing on the side that the U.S. would indeed survive 100 years and more. So strong was Ben's belief in our founding principles that he endowed not one, but two trusts, one in his native Boston and the other in his adopted city, Philadelphia. With £1,000 each, which was about $5,000 back then, and is about $100,000 in today's money, not an insignificant amount. Ben instructed the trust to make loans at a 5% rate of interest to young men under the age of 25 to finance their apprenticeships in the trades. You know, as a side note, I'm amazed at Ben's wisdom and his choice to invest that bet money on apprenticeship programs that trained America's younger generations to make our nation strong. Wow, that guy was all in. Now, Ben specified that half the money be distributed after 100 years and the balance after 200 years. So, how did Ben do? After the first 100 years, his $5,000 Boston fund had grown to $391,000. That's a 4.5% compounded annual return. As Ben had instructed, half of this money was distributed and used to establish the Ben Franklin Institute of Technology, which still exists today. The other half stayed invested and grew to $5 million by 1989, 200 years after Ben's 1789 bet was made. While the Boston Trust did well, the Philadelphia Trust did not perform as well, primarily because corrupt politicians raided its coffers early on and diverted funds for pet projects. Even so, by 1989, the Philly Fund had grown to about $2 million and was used to offer scholarships to Philadelphia high school graduates. Sadly, Ben's trust did not grow to their full potential of hundreds of millions of dollars because a number of early borrowers defaulted on loans and because funds were grossly mismanaged and misappropriated. But the lesson still stays. Despite abusive practices, the funds grew nicely in value even after adjusting for inflation, and Ben's original mandate clearly shows Ben's understanding of the power of compounding. In his Seeking Alpha article, John Thomas illustrates the power of compounding through a famous legend about the origin of chess that goes like this. When the inventor of the game showed it to the Emperor of India, the Emperor was so impressed by the new game that he said to the man, "Name your reward." The man responded, "O Emperor, my wishes are simple. I only wish for this. Give me one grain of rice for the first square of the chessboard, 2 grains for the next square, 4 for the next, 8 for the next, and so on for all 64 squares, with each square having double the number of grains as the square before." The emperor agreed, amused that the man had asked for such a small reward. Or so he thought, until after a week, the emperor's treasurer informed him that the reward would add up to an astronomical sum far greater than all the rice that could conceivably be produced in many, many centuries. That's the power of compounding. Now, I don't know how the fable ended. I'm certain the emperor did not fully pay out because that was physically impossible. I just hope he realized the wisdom of the inventor and made him part of his inner circle of advisors, but you know, you never know. Back then, beheadings were pretty common, and if the emperor had a thin skin and a poor sense of humor, beware. Now, here's something I'd like to add. The key to the snowballing of your initial investment is that you avoid being overly active with managing your investments. Here's how I'd like you to do it. Pick a few solid companies with stable finances and good long-term prospects, ideally with decent dividends too. Even index funds work well here too. Then add this to your portfolio every month, every quarter, every year, the best you can. Don't trade in and out and waste your money on fees and commissions. Don't try to time the market. Don't dump when the market crashes. Don't speculate on hot stocks. Don't let your emotions get the better of you, and you'll be fine. As simple as this sounds, there is a hard part, and that is keeping your desire for action and your emotions out of the equation. If you get overly active or try to second-guess the market, your results won't be all that impressive. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you end up losing money by being overly active in managing it. So, if you want your wealth to grow, invest it in a few good stocks or index funds, reinvest your dividends back into those, and forget about it for 20 or 30 years. And if you really want to see some magic, add to your portfolio every month, every quarter, and watch your wealth snowball. All right, wrapping it up, let me just add this. With respect to the just-finished Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholder meeting, I'm also reminded of Warren Buffett and the two things he shares in common with Benjamin Franklin: his belief in the power of compounding to snowball your wealth, and his other belief that it's always a terrible idea to bet against America. So, my friends, may the force of compounding be with each and every one of you, and I sincerely hope you use it well to grow your wealth.
Very unnecessary. Is that swingy symphony a dinkity, a dinkity, a dinkity? Oh, what a tune for crooning! Ink, a dinkity, a dinkity, a dinkity. It's got the whole world swooning. Eskimo bells up in.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. From a meager Frankfurter stand in Coney Island, New York in 1916 to America's most loved and iconic household brand, Nathan's Famous is an icon we all know. My next guest is the grandson of the founder of Nathan's Famous, and he has written the book Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, and it chronicles the milestones and centennial history and business strategies of the company's founder, Nathan Handwerker. My guest, Bill Handwerker. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bill, how did it all start? Way back when, in 1916 in Coney Island, give us kind of a picture of the way things were back then.
Well, Grandfather Nathan came to this country in 1912, not knowing how to speak, read, or write. And he was able to overcome that and got into the food service business via a luncheonette, Max's Busy Bee. And in 1914, he went to Coney Island during the summer to try and make some more money, and eventually in 1916, opened up his own restaurant.
The restaurant served what in particular?
He served frankfurters, french fries, and malted milkshakes. Mm-hmm.
So that was a pretty popular fare back then?
Yes. Well, throughout Coney Island, they were selling Frankfurters for 10 cents, and he felt that in order to grow his business, he had to try something different, and he opened it up for 5 cents, and the rest is history.
Now, I would think he was pretty smart about business, so he tried this 5 cents, but wasn't he worried that people would think that the quality was inferior? Because there's a story in the book about how he got some white coats from the local hospital. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, the competitors were not too happy with my grandfather, and they spread rumors that he was using inferior meats, and that's the only way he could afford to sell it for 5 cents. So he went to Coney Island Hospital, and he borrowed doctor's coats and stethoscopes and gave them to people in front of the restaurant and gave them free franks. And when people passed by and saw that doctors were eating the franks, they said, well, if it's good enough for doctors, it's good enough for me.
Oh, those were simple times, weren't they?
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah. Now, see, what particularly interests me, and I know there's a lot to this story, we have a limited time. What particularly interests me that I think is important for those of us in business today is that, you know, here he entered a business where there was a lot of competition and he was trying to figure out a way to differentiate himself. So one way he did was through price, for sure, but there had to be more than that. What else was different about Nathan's hot dogs at the time?
Well, I think it was not just the hot dogs, but that he was, you know, he concentrated on the service of it. And I believe that quality of combining quick service and quality food was the difference. And I tell people that I think that my grandfather's stand was really the first true fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm. So he understood how to make a consistent product in a clean atmosphere and get it to the customer fast. Was there a point in time when, let's say, a movie star or someone famous picked up on it that launched the brand even further?
Well, there was several people throughout the company's history. Right from the get-go, when he was working at Felton's Beer Gardens, Eddie Cantor and Jimmy Durante were singing waiters, and as the story goes, tried to convince him, and they were going to lend him the money to open up his own restaurant and sell it for a nickel. But he did it on his own, and throughout history, from politicos of Nelson Rockefeller, who said, you can't hope to be elected in New York State without eating a Frankfurter in front of Nathan's, to Bobby Kennedy's first run, Barbara Streisand sent them over to London. And the kicker is Walter Matthau had them served at his funeral.
Yeah, so, yeah. Talk about iconic brands and the meaning behind just, you know, your plain old fashioned, good quality hot dog. So there was more to it, though. When did the hot dog eating contest actually start?
It was in the early 1970s. And yes, in terms of PR, you know, Nathan's reputation was much larger than the actual business, and our monies had to be spent as most efficiently as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we had these two gentlemen, PR people, Morty Matz and Max Rosie, who thought up the idea by, they had a client, Hess's department store, and they ran a donating contest, and it was successful.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought that if that was successful, how can you imagine how successful a hot dog eating contest would be? And that's how it began.
The book is Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, An Unauthorized View of America's Favorite Frankfurter Company. Now, Bill, you worked in the business for quite a while. Tell us about a little bit about your father and your experience working there.
My father, when he came back from World War II, was truly the impetus for the expansion of the company. You know, the generation of my grandparents and that generation of immigrants felt that it was most important to take care of the immediate family and the extended family, and that Coney Island was sufficient. When my father came back from the war, he said, Pop, we have to grow, and that all the GIs coming back are moving out of Brooklyn, a lot were moving out of Brooklyn to Long Island and Westchester and so forth. And it was his impetus to expand the restaurants itself. And going further than that, when I came on board full time, we had just began a major effort in the supermarket program of packaged Frankfurters. And basically, you know, That's how the company grew to where it is today, going through many different gyrations, obviously the ups and the downs. But the bottom line is that the quality of the product is what kept this company going and expanding to where it is today.
You know, you'll find this interesting, but a few weeks ago, I interviewed Patricia Gucci from the Gucci family, and your family's story is very, very similar. There was Guccio Gucci who started the business, very local in Florence. The son, Aldo Gucci, came in after the war, saw the GIs, expanded. It's a very similar story. You may want to get that book to read a little bit about that. Talk about different businesses, but a very common story, perhaps, way back when. Now, things weren't always smooth. You write in the book about something called the Wetson effect. I'd like to know what lessons were learned from that experience.
Well, at that time, my father had growth plans in his mind, and the Wetsons was in the New York market and Connecticut, New Jersey, North Jersey, as really the primary hamburger fast food outlet. And they had troubled times, and we purchased the company, but it was too many locations. And as everyone knows, location, location, location. And the bottom line is that was a lesson learned. And fortunately, through a lot of hard work and effort, we were able to work through that overexpansion, back to consolidation, and the brand move forward. But the lesson learned there is that infamous or a famous expression, location, 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 and the Wetson stores that were not successful as Wetsons were not successful as Nathans. And that was a lesson well learned.
From reading the book, too, it was, I think, also a question of cash flow in order to sustain and to actually create the synergies between the Wetson and the Nathan's brand. My guest is Bill Handwerker. He's the grandson of Famous Nathan. And the book he wrote about that is called Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, An Unauthorized View of America's Favorite Frankfurter Company. Bill Handwerker, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. And if anyone is interested in getting a hold of me, you can get me on Facebook, Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years.
Very good. Thank you.
The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
You know, I was thinking the other day that as summer has definitely arrived and life is slowing down just a bit, it would be fun to have a casual little get-together with all of you. Kind of like a bagels on the beach in Boca, only it's not in Boca, so we're calling it pastries on the beach in Pompano. Not a seminar, not a live event, though it will be live, of course. Just a meet and greet at a nice location where you can come and ask me questions about your financial life, and I'll try my best to answer them. This is also a good time to get a second opinion on your financial stuff, so feel free to bring any statements or documents you want me to look at. So what do you think, huh? We made a date, July 16th at 9 a.m. We're going to keep it to 20 people, and literally we're going to have it at a hotel on the beach in Pompano with pastries, and more too, of course. Oh, and if that doesn't work for you, I'm also opening my doors for you to come into our office as well and experience the same thing. Without the bagels or the beach, though we are in Boca, and we'd love to see you at either location. Again, the date, July 16th at 9 a.m. It's at the Marriott Pompano Beach Resort and Spa. Go to stevepomerantz.com for information and to sign up. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Catherine Collins is author of The Nature of Investing. After a long and successful career in equity management at Fidelity Management and Research Company, Catherine reinvented herself, earning a Master of Theological Studies degree at Harvard Divinity School. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You know, Catherine, that's quite a leap from stock trading to philosophy. What made you take that leap?
You know, it's funny. I don't think it's a path that's been taken by too many people. And yet the parallels between my theology studies and my studies of natural systems and my investing career were really much stronger than I even imagined myself. I really reached a point in my career as an investor where I wanted to step back a little bit and reflect on the real purpose of investing in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, I found that going to study philosophy and moral philosophy, really more specifically, was a great place to start.
Well, your book speaks to the idea that following natural systems is a better way of looking at your investments and, I guess, looking at running companies and the like. Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, one trend that I experienced firsthand as an investor over the last 20, 25 years is that we've taken increasingly a little bit of a factory approach to investing, always looking for more efficiency, more automation, more mechanization in some ways. And this trend started to trouble me after a while, and it eventually led me to the study of natural systems. And the point I've reached in those studies is this examination of biomimicry as a great model. And what biomimicry asks you to do before you make a decision or design a product or a process is to pause for a moment, try to reflect on exactly what function it is that you're trying to perform. You know, what's the point? And to be clear on that, and then to ask yourself, what would nature do? WWND, you know, how would nature perform this same essential function? And to use that as your starting point instead of leaping straight for the factory model.
So this is a new word to everyone. It's biomimicry, and it's obviously mimicking the biology and what's going on in nature. But drill down a little bit and give us some examples of how we would follow a natural system for something.
Sure. So one premise that is embedded in a lot of business and investing endeavors is the premise of growth. And pretty often we take some shortcuts in our thinking about growth and we look at just maximizing growth. But if you look at a natural system like a beehive, for example, bees don't just build the biggest hive they possibly can right at the outset. They build the hive as it's needed, kind of a just-in-time approach. And importantly, they build it only as quickly as there are resources to support the ongoing maintenance and real vitality of that hive.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every investor, I think, has had a similar experience where they invested in an endeavor that looked like a real sprinter out of the gates, if you will, and eventually that sprinter stumbled because they didn't invest enough in maybe people or systems or infrastructure to support that rapid growth.
Or maybe companies that built too far, too much, too fast in anticipation
exactly.
of what they thought was to come, but they kind of outbuilt the capacity for customers or whatever it might be.
Right. It's a very common mistake. And it's not saying growth is bad or even that fast growth is bad, but it's really focusing on how that growth is achieved as opposed to just what is achieved.
Well, you talked about the financial industry and the kind of this cookie cutter mechanized approach that takes place much of the time. We have even now, you know, the vast majority of transactions that take place being in this high frequency trading model where within milliseconds, you know, millions and millions of transactions are done. So what are the biggest challenges facing the financial industry today, in your view?
I think, in my mind, there's a real distinction between investing and finance. And it's not a familiar distinction to many people, but to me, investing is really that primary transaction where you're trying to create something in the world, something of use and of value. So there's mutual exchange, there's connection, there's mutual benefit. And that's still at the core of what investing is really all about. What has grown really quickly, though, in recent decades is all the tools and mechanics and products and processes that surround that core. And that's what I call financing. It's the processing and the packaging and the reprocessing and repackaging often that we see around that core activity. And what I'd like to do with this book is just really orient all of us as investors back towards that essential core and to get closer in connection to what's actually happening in the world. It has a lot of parallels actually to the food system, you know, where we centralized a lot of things and automated a lot of things. And now we're finding a lot of people trying to peel away some of those layers of processing and get a little closer to those primary ingredients again.
Well, your book speaks to this biomimicry, and you say the simple question at its core is this WWND, what would nature do? So give us some practical examples of how biomimicry can be used in investing.
Sure. What one thing that I did early on is just really looked at my own portfolio with these principles of nature in mind. And I realized that there were a lot of things in my portfolio where they did have that essential connection and kind of reciprocal relationship embedded in them. But sure enough, there were a lot of, you know, funds of funds and securities of securities.
Yeah.
And I tried really hard to step back and look at my own life and what purpose those vehicles were serving when it came to my own investment goals. And if I couldn't come up with a really clear purpose and a reason for them to be there, I took that as an opportunity to trim out some of those layers and to find solutions that were still very active solutions, but maybe a little simpler, a little more elegant in their construction, as opposed to maybe overly engineered, as they were in some cases for me.
You know, it seems like a process that would reduce a lot of the noise that's in the system today that investors have so much trouble dealing with. And I think you make a very good point. You have these products of products or funds of funds, or you have derivatives based on something else, and then you have a new derivative based on the derivatives of that something else. And you've lost touch with what's going on in the core, and it's good to kind of come back to what the core meaning is. I know one big theme in the book as well is what you call feedback loops. And, you know, perhaps you can explain it when you're talking about the beehive again. Where's the feedback loop in a beehive, and how can we as investors utilize that to improve our results?
Sure. Well, feedback loops are a really important element of any natural system, and really, in fact, any system that functions in an effective way. And what you need for feedback loops are three things. One is a clear signal. The second is a receptor for that signal. And then the third is an appropriate response, not just any response, but an appropriate response. So if you think of that in a beehive, for example, bees are just terrific communicators, and we have a lot of great scientific research on this now. When bees communicate about resources for pollen and nectar, for example, they come back and they convey not only the location, but also the quality of the pollen and nectar. And importantly, it doesn't stop there. There's also a series of feedback loops coming from within the hive. So when there's actually enough pollen and nectar that's been gathered, the bees slow down their activity. Again, they don't just maximize for the sake of maximizing. There's a sense of sufficiency. So there are a couple things there to notice. One is that the loops actually feed on themselves and connect in a really wonderful way. And the second is that they're multidimensional. So when I look at that and compare it to investments, for a lot of us, our primary feedback loop is just price. And we've gotten really precise about that. You can get, you know, microsecond pricing data now. But I wonder if having, you know, microseconds of pricing data is as valuable as having similar data on something else, you know, maybe environmental impact or social impact or the how of growth that we talked about before. It seems to me that having a little less information on price and a little more information on other dimensions might help us to have a healthier system of feedback loops.
Yeah, so it's a question of the quality of information. Price does have information, but is it, you know, the end-all be-all of all the information that you need to get a good response in this feedback loop to make the best decision possible?
Exactly. And to me, this is very familiar. You know, I grew up in an investment organization that focused on fundamental research, and you would never just look at revenues, for example, and not examine the rest of the financial statements. So I think this is something good investors are already very familiar with, and it's just putting it in a little different context.
My guest is Catherine Collins, and the book is The Nature of Investing, and you can kind of see the framework about this. We've got about a minute left, Catherine. You know, there was a part in the book that was very simple. You were talking about your colleagues at Fidelity and how you would all have to, it wasn't going around the water cooler so much, but there was some other place where you'd have to get, the Quotron.
Yeah.
Years ago, nobody had really a computer at their desk. You had one Quotron in the middle of the office somewhere, and everybody would gather around to get their quotes. And that was a form of getting feedback on what was going on in the world. Take us through that real quick.
Absolutely. So this is a perfect example of something that's gotten much more efficient, but maybe less effective. So to get pricing information on stocks, and this isn't that long ago, it's the early 1990s, we still had to walk down the hall to a shared terminal and type in tickers one by one and wait for the information to come back to us. Now I can do that any minute of the day all over the world, just in my pocket on my phone. There's 10 apps that do it immediately. So the volume of information has gotten much more dramatic, and the speed has gotten much more efficient. In theory, that's a great thing. But what we benefited from were a few things. First, we had to actually walk down the hall with intent. You really had to wonder what the price was doing and have a reason to wonder about it. Mm-hmm. So there was an intention in the questioning. But most importantly, it connected us all to each other personally and also to what was happening in the rest of the market. You know, I would be there looking up construction stocks, but my colleague would be looking at oil prices. And then a third person would be looking at retail comps for the month. And you couldn't help but kind of soak up all that exchange. And it was a very organic, kind of natural bottom-up system. It wasn't something that had to be automated or mechanized.
So lots of questions that you want to ask in terms of how to take a more natural approach to investing. The book is The Nature of Investing. Very interesting stuff to read. My guest, Catherine Collins. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, a lot of people are remodeling their homes rather than selling or buying a new home. So it brings this question up as to whether you can recoup, or to what amount can you recoup different projects that you may have.
Well, I always say when you remodel, do it for yourself. But keep in mind, one day you may want to resell it, so don't go, you know, way crazy on the deep end on what you do and make it so, I don't know, outright feel that it's not attractive to many people. But having said all of that, Steve, the average recoup is about 66%, I would say.
So for every dollar you spend, the average is 66 cents that you'll get back on.
Correct. Now, of course, as time goes on, this would be, you know, relatively immediately. So if you were to enhance the kitchen and then put the house up for sale, that's what you're looking at. If you enhance the kitchen and then go to sell your house 10 years from now.
Okay.
You know. Yeah. So what does that look like? For example, people always ask, well, should I do this? Should I do that?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to change out a garage door, it's about 97%.
So garage doors, I always see that at the top of the list.
I know. Why? this must be an up north thing. I don't know.
Either they're very cheap, or you know what it is? It could be curb appeal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
we, you know how important curb appeal
is, right?
So you got that ugly, scratched up wood. But anyway, everybody, replace your garage doors without worry.
Right, right.
Okay, go on.
All right. So the manufactured stone veneer, 94%. Mid-range minor kitchen remodel, 80%.
What is mid-range price? 50?
Depends.
75?
I mean, what are they basing?
Well,
oh, so let's say the median price home we just read is like 256.
Yeah, so it can't be 50.
It would be
15, 20,000. Yeah.
Okay. I guess would be wood deck additions. You know, that's not a big thing in South Florida.
No.
Yeah, a pool would be more.
Yeah. All right, move on.
Siding, replacement of your siding. That's a big thing up north in other parts of the country, 75%.
Okay.
Steel entry door replacements, 75%. Vinyl window replacements, 73%. Fiberglass grain.
Wait, stop. What is vinyl window?
I have no idea.
I'm going to look into that.
It's kind of like, I don't know, I'm thinking of the Three Little Pigs. The house made of straw, the house
vinyl?
Made of...
Was vinyl one of them?
No, well, you know, I mean, how good is vinyl for
a
window?
We've talked enough about that. Number eight, these are all really boring.
I know.
Okay, vinyl window, steel entry door. I guess if you're going to have a steel entry door, you're going to get 75% of your money back.
And wood window replacement. So all of these that they're showing, these are the top 10 projects. They're running anywhere from 70 to 95%.
Okay, I have a Florida question for
you.
Yay. Okay. And I know you have some experience in this. What about impact windows?
Oh, yes.
It's a big deal. So
huge deal.
Tell us what you know.
Okay, so impact windows and age of roofs are probably my two biggest issues. So for example, I had a gentleman who's got his house up for sale, is asking $1.4 million. Everybody coming through, it's a big house, like 5,000 square feet. Everybody's, oh, but it doesn't have impact windows. Well, the impact of that is probably, I don't know, we haven't priced it out, but I'm going to say it's a $100,000 investment.
Sure.
So the seller's like, okay, I'm getting tired of everybody telling me it needs this, it needs that. What if I go out and install impact windows? Why don't I spend the $100,000?
Yeah.
That's great. It'll make the house more attractive. But the real question is, if you spend that $100,000, are you going to be able to recoup that $100,000?
That is the $64,000 question. So,
correct.
Number one, if he's not getting any kind of action on the house because of this issue, then having impact windows will take away that obstruction.
That's an objection because there's other objections. The house needs to be updated. There are other objections.
Is it an excuse?
And here, you just said it, it is an excuse. At the end of the day, when you hear it needs this, it needs that, what it's really saying is you're priced too high. I don't see the value at the price that you are asking.
So under that scenario, the real scenario,
the moral to this story is, and I told him, just reduce the price of the house to where the market is. The market's not accepting our price.
Right. Okay.
Save the $100,000.
Okay. Well, that's good. So what have we learned from impact windows? First of all, if you've got 5,000 square feet, do you really want to put up corrugated sheet metal?
No.
Over every
plywood
window?
On the second floor?
Well, yeah. You know.
Huge sheets of over very large windows.
Well, you're hiring people to do this. And I will tell you, though, there is a downside to impact windows. Okay. So I've been down in Florida for a really long time. I've lived through a lot of hurricanes. And we used to have put the corrugated sheet metal up on there. And at one time, we used to tape our windows.
Tape,
we thought
that's
that was
right,
smart.
Duct tape.
That was really stupid, but we thought it was smart. Anyway, what was going on outside stayed outside because you couldn't see it. But with impact windows, you can see everything.
Flying by.
And you feel like it's the Wizard of Oz.
And
you're Dorothy in the house.
It's kind of
terrible.
Cool.
No, it's terrible.
I enjoyed it, actually. But what people don't realize, these impact windows will crack, okay?
Under a certain, what do you mean they'll crack?
They will break. They won't.
If they're struck
if they're
by
struck,
an object
you will
at
get,
a certain,
they will crack.
Yeah.
So now you have cracked windows that you have to replace. So you might be better off keeping your impact windows and accordion shutters.
Okay. Oh, gosh. No, yeah. Maybe since I don't like
just
watching it.
Just carry insurance.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So we only have a little bit of time left.
Sure.
But I do want to go through this one letter to Dear Ann. This is, Dear Ann, my seller and I had a falling out. Now, this is a broker writing to, I guess, a broker magazine or something. My seller and I had a falling out. He asked me to cancel our listing agreement, and at first I refused, but upon consideration, I told him that we would release him if he paid the cancellation fee. The seller said, absolutely not. He's not paying no fee. And so they're still in limbo as I write, as this broker says. Add to this that a new broker was brought on board, and they actually took out the first broker's sign, put in the new. That started a fight. Now she's asking the question, the broker is asking the question, is this ethical with regards to how brokers are allowed to treat each other?
Yeah, no, wrong. We have to take a code of ethics, and this is like right at the top of the game here. First of all, the second broker needs to ask the seller, what kind of listing agreement do you have? Mm-hmm. So if it's an exclusive right to list, which most of them are, you can't just willy-nilly decide, oh, okay, you don't like your first broker, now I'm your broker. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that, and for me, what I would is insist in seeing something in writing saying that they've been released. You're also protecting, you have an obligation to that seller too. You don't want to jeopardize that seller and put them in a situation now where the seller may owe two commissions because of your aggressiveness in insisting on going ahead and being the second broker, even though it hasn't been released from the first broker.
That
so
makes sense.
As realtors, we need to follow our code of ethics and watch and protect the seller as well.
Now, I can understand the seller's point of view of not wanting to pay the cancellation fee because if you believe that the broker underperformed, then in a sense, you feel there's a breach of contract. But then the broker says, well, I put in this time, I've
and
done
money.
The advertising and all of that, and so I need some compensation for that. So it can stand in limbo.
Right, until the listing expires. Now, what that seller should do is reach out to the broker, not the agent, but the broker, go above the agent, go to the broker and see what deal can be made. Honestly, if a seller doesn't want to work with me, I shake their hands, let's part as friends, and let's go.
Yeah, because what's the point?
But that's a personal decision between the real estate brokerage.
Well,
and
that's
the
why I have you on the show,
that's
Terry
right.
Story. Terry is with us every single week. She's a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. My guest today is Earl Stewart. Earl is the owner of one of the top Toyota dealerships in the nation, and has been in the car business since 1968. After learning the ropes, Earl realized that the business he was in was full of high-pressure haggling techniques, deceptive advertising, manipulative tricks of the trade that gave the dealership a significant advantage over the customer. So he decided to change the way he did business, and he changed the way his dealership sold cars, and he became even more successful doing so. About 4 years ago, Earl wrote a book geared towards the consumer titled Confessions of a Recovering Car Dealer, and he's here to talk about it. Earl Stewart, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's an honor to be on National Public Radio. I'm really flattered that I was asked to appear.
You know, Earl, this is a great book. Man, I'm going to recommend it highly to my listeners. We're going to put it up on our website and list it as one of the top books that I recommend. It's a tell-all book on how to buy a car without getting ripped off. And you reveal the inside information on the car dealer's playbook when you walk into the showroom. You know, how have your fellow dealers taken to you revealing all these secrets?
Well, Steve, I'm not very popular with the dealers. I'll never get elected president of the dealer association. They're resentful, and I can understand why. The car dealers have been the last, if they ever do enter the 21st century in terms of consumerism. So they resent my posture, positions, and talking about something they don't like to talk about.
You know, buying a car is a harrowing experience, I think, for most of us. You know, you're a consumer and you're at an immediate knowledge disadvantage. You know, the salesmen are selling cars day in and day out. They're getting training on sales. They're honing their skills every day. And the consumer goes in, what, once every 4 years or more, and with just one simple desire, hey, I want to buy a new car. How do you take this uneven playing field and make it more even?
Well, unfortunately, it's a lot of hard work. In a nutshell, what I advise my listeners, my blog readers or my book readers, is essentially to do their homework. And the best and surest way to get a fair price on a car is competitive comparison, you know, picking out the exact car you want to buy. You can never vary the car. When you decide what you want, get prices from at least three dealerships on that car. Competitiveness is on the consumer side, but never, ever buy a car from the first or even the second dealer you talk to.
Yeah, so one advantage you can create for yourself is by getting dealers to compete against each other.
Exactly.
Okay.
Competition is intense in the car business, and there's really too many car dealers. Their price competition is unprecedented, and unless you take advantage of that, you're not going to get a good price.
So when I go to choose a car, what are some of the important factors that I need to consider? You know, there's the purchase of the car, there's the actual enjoying the use of the car, and then there's that value at the end, the trade-in value or the residual value.
Yes.
Should I consider, you know, the purchase through the sale as the cost of my total purchase or just concentrate on the purchase?
Well, you have to look at the real price of the car. The advertised price or even the price that you pay is not the true cost of that car, because that car, when you purchase it, is going to depreciate over 3 or 4 or 5 years, however long you keep it. You should determine the resale value of that car, and it's a very easy way to do that, and that's by the auto lease card, ALG, auto lease guide. And every dealer uses the auto lease guide. Every leasing company and bank uses that. You can determine the residual value of your car. And if you're going to keep it 3 years, you can find out whether your car is going to be worth 60% or 65% of the purchase price, or only maybe 25 or 30%. Huge difference.
Yeah. So you may have car A and car B, and maybe even car A is cheaper to buy, but the residual value at the end is much lower. So when you add in all the costs together, you think you're getting a good deal by buying it for less, car A for less, but in fact, you're not.
Exactly. I mean, there are cars that will depreciate 38 to 40% in the first year of ownership, and there are cars that will depreciate maybe only 5 or 6%.
Yeah.
So there's a huge difference between the depreciation of cars, and you need to know that before you make your buying decision.
You know, one feature that you mentioned in your book was choosing the right color car, and I was kind of surprised to see that. Tell us why that's important.
Well, people tend to want to buy the car that's in their favorite color. And a lot of us have peculiar colors. Some people, my wife, for example, loves purple. Now, she went out and bought herself a purple Lexus. The resale value on that Lexus in 4 or 5 years would be thousands of dollars less, because most people don't like purple Lexus. So you should look for the popular colors within the brand style of car. Black, silver, white are the three most popular colors. But if you're buying a sports car, red or a flashy color would be suitable. But you need to find the popular color of the model and make car you're buying.
Yeah, so know that if you do make a decision based upon your emotions and your feelings about a particular color, you're probably, there's a good chance you may pay the price at the end. And if you're willing to accept that price, go forth, right?
Exactly. The wrong color can cost a car $3,000 in resale value easily.
My guest today is Earl Stewart. He's the owner of one of the top Toyota dealerships in South Florida. And he's also written a telltale book called Confessions of a Recovering Car Dealer. And this is what we're talking about with Earl today. By the way, Earl has his own radio show local to the South Florida market. The call letters are 900 a.m. and he's on Tuesdays from 4 to 6. So he's a fellow radio guy and also got into it not being a radio guy, just like me. I was an investment advisor who became a radio person for the last 15 years myself. You know, Earl, it's not only the salesmen and the sales managers in the dealerships that have the advantage or are manipulative, but the manufacturers have manipulative techniques too. One of them is this thing you called stair-step pricing. What is that?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, that's an insidious, very anti-consumer incentive plan that the manufacturers have for their dealers. And what it does is it puts a very high incentive that is accumulated up to a certain quota that they must sell. So a manufacturer tells a particular dealer he must sell 100 cars in a month. They might put $500 bonus on every car he sells, but they don't collect it till they hit their 100th unit, and it's retroactive. So that would be $10,000 bonus that he would collect, or $100,000 bonus that he would collect on his last car. And that makes it unfair to the people that buy cars early in the month, because the bonus doesn't occur till the last of the month.
Yeah.
And it causes crazy pricing and makes it very difficult for the consumer to plan their car shopping and pricing, because the car that's bought at the early part of the month is a lot higher than the cars that are bought at the end of the month.
Well, I mean, I guess the salesman can say in good faith that this is the best price he can give you, let's say on the beginning of the month, knowing that there's a strong possibility, but not necessarily. I mean, is this information passed down to the salesman?
I tell my listeners to my radio show, and that sounds like an old wives' tale, but the fact of the matter is the end of the month is positively the best time to negotiate a good price for the car.
Sure.
I tell people do their homework earlier in the month, but don't make their purchase until the last two or three days of the month.
Yeah, because that's when the pressure mounts for them to meet their quotas.
Yes.
Now, are we talking calendar days of the month?
We're talking actual, because sometimes the manufacturers end their month the first or second or third of the next month.
Uh-huh.
Typically, if they fall on a weekend, they'll carry their fiscal month through Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, so if at least you wait until the 30th or the 31st, if there is one, and the first, you're in the ballpark there, and that's the key.
Yeah, 31st or the 1st or the 2nd, you're in pretty good shape.
What is the best time, now that we're talking about the best time to buy a car? So we talked about the month, but when during the year, in terms of the new models, is the best time to buy a new car?
A lot of people think the best time to buy a car is during the mop-up, clean-up toward the end of the year.
Yeah.
When the dealers are moving out their last year's model. You save money up front on that, but you pay in the long run because of depreciation. You're better off to buy a current fresh model. And I recommend that you wait a month or two into the new model year and buy the new model. The prices come down by that time. And if you negotiate well, you'll get a good price on that car. The extra depreciation that you get from buying last year's model offsets the gain from the discount that the dealer advertised.
Now, I guess you could go in, again, being a novice, I don't know if this is realistic, but you could go in and say, hey, I looked at the depreciation or that I'm going to lose and negotiate a price down to the depreciation loss, I suppose.
Well, you could try.
You could try.
You know, the deal.
Yeah. Okay. That's, you don't even have to expand on that. I think that says it all. So let's change gears here, because in the book, throughout the book, you talk about one fee that really tees you off. And it's called the documentation fee. What do you call it? There's this, it's 22 names, right?
You're good to be confused about that, because there's probably 25 different names for it.
Yeah.
Doc fee, dealer fee, dealer prep fee, administration fee, handling fee. The only thing they have in common is the dealers like the word fee very much,
yeah,
because it fools a buyer into thinking it's a government fee, like a sales tax or a license plate.
Yeah. So a salesman says to me, let's say there's a fee of $795. I say to him, well, what is that? And he goes, well, that's our fee to take care of all the documents and all of
this.
And you say, you know, hey, wait a minute. That's the cost of doing business. That's not a real fee.
Sir, if a business can pass along all their costs on the product they sell, they'd be passing along their light bill, their water bill, the salesman's commission, their rent bill.
Yeah.
You can't pass along your costs to your customer. You have to include them in your advertised price and the price that you quote the customer.
What if the dealership says, this fee is not for negotiation? If we charge one person, we have to charge everybody else. It's not for negotiation. What's my comeback for that?
Well, the comeback is you don't care what fee they charge you as long as you include it in the price that you advertise and the price that you quote. And when you're doing competitive shopping, you say, listen, it's okay if you want to add a fee. I want to know my out-the-door price. You give me the out-the-door price, I'm going to talk to two or three other dealers.
Uh-huh.
And if they give me a lower price, I'm going to buy from them. So if you feel like you want to give me that dealer fee, be sure it's included in the price you quote me.
Yeah. So in other words, you can charge me $795 as a dealer fee, but you should reduce the price of the car
exactly.
by $795. Now, there is a problem here with regards to what the salesman's incentive is and what the dealership's incentive is, because the salesman makes a commission on the price of the car and the dealer fee is gravy to the dealership.
Exactly. That dealer fee is pure profit. It goes right in the dealer's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
The salesperson or the sales manager gets no piece of it. So
In
their mind, they don't want to discount the car
That's
by the
right.
amount of the dealer fee
right.
because that comes out of their pocket.
Yeah, and it's actually a double whammy because the dealership is getting the fee and keeping most of the profits.
Yes.
And the salesman is cutting their commissions. So there's a big disincentive for them to do anything, and they're going to fight you.
Exactly. They come up with some imaginative answers as to why the dealer fee exists, because they know that you don't want it, and they can try to come up. They'll say that all the dealers charge it or that it's illegal for me to take it off. They come up with all these creative answers, which none of which are really true, because the dealer fee is something the dealer decides on, nobody else. He can take it off. He can charge one customer and not charge another. It's entirely up to him.
What are some of the most devious statements made by car dealers that you know about and that you've written about?
The worst ones are about leasing. Leasing is where more people are taken advantage of than purchasing. And one of the most cruel things that dealers will tell people that lease cars is that if you change your mind and you don't like the car, you can just bring it back. And that's usually said in the negotiation. It's never put in writing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of elderly people are victimized by this. A lot of elderly people go into a car dealership with the intent of buying a car. Most of them don't even want a lease. And then the salesperson tricks them into saying that, you know, we can get your payment down $200 and you can drive the car for only this much. They make the person think it's like a rental. You know, you rent a car for 2 weeks, you bring it back, and that's the end of it. When you sign that 48-month or 36-month lease contract, you owe 48 or 36 payments. You can't get out of it if you change your mind 2 weeks later. You still owe all of those payments.
I think one of the reasons that leases are mostly sold is because the monthly payment is so much lower.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll go through with that a little bit because that can be very misleading.
Well, when you buy a car, of course, you're building equity. I mean, it doesn't happen for about a year and a half or 2 years because you have the extreme depreciation when you drive that new car off the showroom floor. But if you keep a car for 4 years, usually by the 36 months, you're building equity and you're building capital. When you lease a car, you don't own the car. The leasing company owns the car and you're paying rent on the car and you're building zero equity. So therefore, the car belongs to the lessor when you are through with the lease. They take it out and they'll sell it for several thousand dollars, which you could have sold had you purchased. So there really is no economic advantage to a lease over a purchase. The payment is lower for a very good reason, because you have no equity.
Well, there is this feature that they're guaranteeing what the residual value is, whereas if you own the car, you now have the responsibility of either, you know, they'll tell you, well, you know, if you don't like our deal, go to another dealer. If you don't like their deal, sell it privately.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big hassle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are advantages to leasing. One of the lease advantages is if you have an accident, the car is damaged, that's the liability of the lessor.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you own the car and you have a $3,000 or $4,000 accident,
yeah.
even though it's repaired perfectly, a damaged car is never worth what an undamaged car is. So, so the lessor has to absorb that. Yeah, there are advantages to leasing, and I think that it's more complicated and it's more easy for the dealer to trick people when they buy a lease. There's a lot of fees. There's a lease initiation fee. There's a lease disposition fee.
Right.
There's also the above wear, normal wear and tear fee that you have to pay when you turn your car in. And if you go over a certain minimum number of miles, they charge you 18, 20, 25 cents a mile for over mileage. So there's a lot of minefields, pitfalls to leasing that you have to be aware of.
The book is Confessions of a Recovering Car Dealer. My guest is Earl Stewart, owner of one of the top Toyota dealerships in the nation. I guess somewhat of a pariah to other dealers.
That's a good word.
Maybe your next book will include the pariah in the title. But Earl has really decided to go the honest route, and he's actually created a company that has done that. And guess what, folks? It has increased his sales over time. Earl, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back on the show later.
Steve, I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me on.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, I was thinking the other day that as summer has definitely arrived and life is slowing down just a bit, it would be fun to have a casual little get-together with all of you. Kind of like a bagels on the beach in Boca, only it's not in Boca, so we're calling it pastries on the beach in Pompano. Not a seminar, not a live event, though it will be live, of course. Just a meet and greet at a nice location where you can come and ask me questions about your financial life, and I'll try my best to answer them. This is also a good time to get a second opinion on your financial stuff, so feel free to bring any statements or documents you want me to look at. So what do you think, huh? We made a date, July 16th at 9 a.m. We're going to keep it to 20 people, and literally, we're going to have it at a hotel on the beach in Pompano with pastries. And more, too, of course. Oh, and if that doesn't work for you, I'm also opening my doors for you to come into our office as well and experience the same thing without the bagels or the beach, though we are in Boca, and we'd love to see you at either location. Again, the date, July 16th at 9 a.m., it's at the Marriott Pompano Beach Resort and Spa. Go to stevepomerantz.com for information and to sign up. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.